Oh, thank you, Jennifer. So last day, in the spirit of it being Saturday morning and the last day, this will be talk mostly of cartoons. So this is not one of the hard talks. This is going to be smooth sailing. Basically, no math. It's going to be a lot of pictures, and I'm going to be focusing on some phenomena and what those phenomena entail. But hopefully, at the end of it, you'll have a good understanding of quantum cryptography. You'll know something about hidden variable models of quantum mechanics, and you'll understand Bell's theorem. So that's the hope. So I want to start off with a comic, which I think nicely captures the situation with quantum theory. So the analogy to quantum theories here is jerks. So quantum theory is like jerks. It makes the life of the physicist very hard, very difficult. But it does make life interesting. I do foundations of quantum mechanics because it's extremely mysterious and nobody understands it and it's fascinating. So hopefully I'll be able to communicate to you some of the mystery of quantum theory in this talk. So at this point, you've probably heard about quantum theory. It was developed in the 20s by people like Schrodinger and Heisenberg, de Broglie and Einstein, and of course Bohr. And I'll just launch straight into looking at some phenomena, which I'm then going to make use of to describe cryptography. So I'm going to talk about the Stern-Gerlach apparatus. Some of you may have heard this already. So the idea is that you have here an oven that spits out, for instance, silver atoms. And you place a magnet in their path, which has a particular shape, which leads to an inhomogeneous magnetic field here. And the result of that is to split the beam into two components. So if you look here, you'll always find the particles emerging here or here. But you find that with this oven in place, if you turn down the amplitude, so there's just one atom coming through at a time, you find that you only ever find the atom here or in the bottom path. So, and if you take a lot of statistics, you find half the time it comes out up and half the time it comes out down. So what I want to do is just introduce a cartoon for these boxes. So this is the source, and this I'm just going to write as a Z box, right? So this is the direction in which the magnet is lined, is the Z axis. And then there's two little lights on this box indicating whether the measurement inside found the particle to be coming out along the up path or the down path. Okay, so all of this is now going to be in a box with a little light on it. So the idea is that if I press the button on the source, then half the time I see the green light come on, and half the time I see the red light come on. And what's going on in the box actually isn't going to be important for what I'm telling you. There's lots of other experiments I could put in a box that have the same kind of phenomenology as what I'm telling you. So from now on, you can sort of forget about what's going on inside and just focus on what we're seeing these happen with these lights. The other box that I want you to imagine is the same thing, except now with this magnet oriented up along the z-axis. So imagine rotating this thing forward. Okay, and I'm going to indicate that as a box with an X on it. And similar phenomena happens here. If you press the button on the source, half the time you get the green light coming on, half the time you get the red light coming on. Okay, now, what happens if after you've detected the particle in the first box, you let it, you recombine the beams in the previous slide. Imagine that after looking to see whether it was up or down, you had some other magnets that recombine the beams and let them come out of the box. After that's done, what if you pass it through another Z box? What happens? You get green 100% of the time. So you reproduce the result of your first measurement. And if you get red, then you reproduce the red result on the second box. So that's fine. Same thing with the X boxes. If I get green on the first, I'll get green on the second, and if I get red on the first, I'll get red on the second. So that's simple enough. Consecutive measurements always give you the same outcome, if they're the same measurement. Now, what happens if I have two different measurements? So let's say I have a Z-box, I get the green outcome, and then I measure along the X-direction, what happens? Right, you get 50-50 results. So half the time you see the green result, half the time you see the red result. And if you get the red, it's the same thing. So the outcome of an X measurement is uncorrelated with the outcome of an immediately preceding Z measurement. And if I reverse the order, X and then Z, I would find the same thing, uncorrelated outcomes between the two. OK, now we get to the first truly interesting case, which is if I do Z, X, and then Z again. So suppose I do the Z measurement and I happen to get the green outcome. Now, what's going to happen after it with the X box? It's going to be 50-50. Good. So let's suppose I do that measurement and I just happen to get the red outcome. Now here's the question. What's going to happen on the final Z box? Because there's two clear possibilities, the two intuitions about what might happen. You know that if you were to eliminate this guy, right? If this wasn't here and you just had the source and then you had X and you got red, what would you get for the Z box? 50-50, right. Now, if you eliminated this box, if that weren't here, it would just be two consecutive Z measures. What would you get? Green all the time. So the question I put to you is, how many people think it's going to be green 100% of the time? And how many people think it's going to be 50-50? Good, well, you've been taught well, because that's exactly what it is, 50-50. So there's my slogan for that, that if an intervening an intervening X measurement randomizes the outcome of a Z measurement. So were the X measurement not there, you would get perfect correlation. But by putting that X measurement in place, you randomize the Z result. It's no longer correlated with this one. And the same thing is true if I have X and then Z and then X. So that's sort of bizarre. It means that these intervening measurements mess things up. OK. Now, what can you infer from this sort of thing? Well, let me imagine the following scenario. Suppose there's a setup behind a wall, and the particles that are prepared get passed out into the world and handed over to this guy. And this guy is told, look, we prepared this particle using one of these Z boxes, and your task is to tell us whether we have the green outcome or the red outcome. So the question is, what strategy can this guy use to answer that question?
Get a Z box.
Right. Pass the particle into a Z box and see what outcome you get. So suppose he does it and he gets the green outcome. What can he infer? It must have been green. And if he gets the red outcome, then he infers it must have been red. So he can answer that question. Even though he didn't see the outcome behind the wall, he can figure out, by doing some measurements, what that outcome must have been. So it's possible to distinguish between a particle that was prepared with one of these Z and then green outcomes, as opposed to one that was prepared with a Z and then red outcome. But now here's a different task. Suppose the guy outside the wall is told only that it was either a Z or an X box, and not told what the outcome was. So there's now four possibilities. It could have been X green, X red, Z green, or Z red. And the question is, how can he figure that out? That's right. It's impossible because, certainly given the resources I've told you about that he has available, if he measures with one of these Z boxes, let's say he gets the green result. What can he deduce from that? Well, he knows it could have been the Z box and a green outcome. That's consistent with what he's got. But it might also have been an X box with the green outcome, because we know that half the time, if you have X green, you can get Z green. So it might have been that, but it also might have been the X box with the red outcome. So it's a bit more likely to have been the Z box with the green outcome, but he still doesn't know which of those three things happened. And so he can't tell those four preparations apart.
But after a series of experiments, depending on the outcome, it might mind.
Yeah, if you were to pose a different problem, you're absolutely right. Suppose I told you, look, it's one of these four possibilities, and I'm going to give you a large number of particles, all of which were prepared in that same way, right? So I took a whole bunch of particles, I passed them all through either an X or a Z box, let's say it was X, and I selected only those that gave you the green outcome. So I happen to know that I prepared 1,000 particles that are X green, and then I give them all to you and say, what were they, X green, X red, Z green, or Z red? Then you can do a large number of different measurements on all of them and look at the statistics and infer which of those preparations it was. But if I just give you the one particle, there's nothing you can do to infer precisely which of those outcomes was done. And that's the fact that you can't do it for a single particle is what's actually going to be useful in the applications for quantum photography. So it's all I want to say here is that, you know, if he gets other results, like Z red, the same thing's true. There's lots of different possibilities that are that are consistent, and the same with X green, many possibilities are consistent. So the slogan is, it's impossible to distinguish those four preparations. Now, let's ask what the probability of correctly estimating which of the four proper preparations was done. It's just the probability of guessing, getting Z versus X right, times the probability of getting red versus green right, given that you got Z versus X right. But basically, you have no way of knowing whether it was Z or X. So the probability is a half of guessing correctly. And if you do guess correctly, then you do the measurement, and you're able to infer precisely whether it was red or green, because it'll be a perfect correlation. So once you've guessed correctly, then your probability is one. But your overall probability of guessing correctly is a half. So you can't gain perfect information. You can't make your probability of guessing correctly equal to one. All right, now here's another scheme. Suppose that you're demanded by the people behind the wall, you're asked to pass the particle back behind the wall when you're done with it. Okay? And the people behind the wall are going to do a measurement of the same type that they prepared the particle with. So they prepare the particle with, say, a Z measurement, and they get the red outcome. And then they pass it out into the world, and then when you return it to them, they're going to do another Z measurement. Now, if you get lucky and you happen to guess that you should measure along Z, then what happens? Well, you get the red outcome because it repeats, and you pass it back, and they get the red outcome. So from the perspective of the people behind the wall, that's exactly the same as what would happen if they passed it out into the world and nothing happened. Right? They would just see a repeat of their outcome. So they can't really tell that you did a measurement. But suppose you're unlucky, and you guess that it's an X measurement that you ought to do. Well, then you get a random outcome, green or red. And then what happens behind the wall? Green, red with 50-50 probabilities. So half the time, they get the red outcome, and they don't know that you've done this X measurement. It looks just like nothing happened to the particle. But half the time, they get the green outcome. And then they know that it can't be the case that the particle just passed through the world with nothing happening to it. They know that you got your hands on it, and you did the wrong sort of measurement. And so they can tell that you've tried to gain information. The probability of passing that final test can be calculated. It's the probability of getting Z versus X right times the probability of passing the test, given that you got them right, plus the probability that you guessed wrong times the probability you passed the test, given that you guessed wrong. Because even if you guess wrong, you still have some probability of passing that test just by a random chance. So the overall probability of guessing right is a half. If you did guess right, then you'll always pass the test. You know, if you do a Z measurement here, you'll always pass this test. So your probability passes one. If you happen to do an X measurement, then only half the time will you pass this test. So you add it up, and your probability of passing the test is 3/4. So we can say that information gain causes a disturbance. That's a slogan that people use in quantum information theory, which means that if you try to gain information about something like which of these four preparations was done, then you cause a disturbance in the sense that somebody can detect the fact that you tried to gain that information by doing subsequent measurements on that particle. So you can't attempt to gain information in this way without risking being detected. That's the key phenomena that powers quantum cryptography. So let me pause and ask if there's any questions about that. Good. So I'm going to tell you about the applications of this stuff to cryptography. The first application is quantum counterfeit proof money. So this is a problem that mints always face. There's always a competition between the people who make the money and the people who try to counterfeit. And so there's always more and more elaborate schemes for trying to protect your money from counterfeiting. So let me sort of put it to you. How would you protect money from being counterfeit? What's the idea behind counterfeit protection?
Make it hard to copy,
right. And now the question is there anything you can do that such that the security would rely on the laws of physics rather than just on the difficulty of copying? Because currently the money we have, they make it difficult to copy by, you know, adding watermarks and holograms and things like that. But there's nothing, in principle, impossible about copying that. I just need a lot of resources to make a good copy. So I can put that under a microscope and study it and then make a copy of what I see. So there's nothing about the current counterfeit schemes, there's nothing in the laws of physics that prohibits copying. It's just technological limitations. So the people who make the money think, well, as long as our adversaries don't have, you know, really good technology, they will be unable to copy this. And then usually that fails at some point. That recently in Canada, there was a counterfeit $100 bill, which means that nobody would accept $100 bills anymore. Well, maybe it wasn't so recently. I haven't been here in a while. What quantum mechanics offers is a scheme wherein the security relies on the laws of physics being true. So your security could still fail. It could turn out that quantum mechanics is wrong. And then, you know, perhaps your adversary works. But it's a much more reliable system to say, well, we assume that quantum mechanics is right, and as long as our adversaries, you know, don't know how to violate quantum mechanics, then we're safe. So how does it work? Here's the cartoon. So you take a Canadian $20 bill, and you give it a bit of thickness, and inside of it, you put little storage chambers for silver atoms, for example. And inside each of these storage chambers, you put an atom that's been prepared in some way. So for instance, the first atom can be prepared Z green, the second Z red, and so on. So you just choose these bases at random, and you get random outcomes, but you write it all down. So in the mint, you write down the serial number of this bill, and then you say, okay, the first atom is Z green, and the second atom is Z red, and so on. Okay, so you have a record of how you prepared those atoms. And then you pass it out into the world. Okay. Now, I should tell you that this is not practical yet today. So people are working on quantum information technology, but we don't really have a way of storing quantum information in such that it doesn't decohere over a very long period of time. So with current technology, this wouldn't work. I mean, you can keep these silver atoms for a very short period of time. So this is sort of futuristic technology. And so at that time, the Canadian 20 will look something more like this. Anyhow, this is the scheme. Here's our wall, and you've got a guy on the outside who receives the money with all the preparation. Okay, now, what's going to happen is that when he spends this money at some merchant, then the merchant is going to, say, go to the mint and ask them, is this good money? In reality, the merchant will teleport the information in the qubits to the mint and ask the mint, but let's not worry about that. I don't have time to tell you about quantum teleportation. But let's imagine he just goes to the mint and says, tell me, is this good money or not? So the mint looks at the serial number, and then they perform, they know, you know, how it was prepared, and so they perform the right measurement on each one of them, and they verify that they get the right sorts of outcomes. And now the counterfeiter might try to make a copy of the money. And so the counterfeiter has a low probability of guessing precisely how this thing was prepared. So it's useful for the counterfeiter to do some measurements, to try to get some more information about what the state of those systems are. But the problem is he has to guess what axis to measure along, Z or X. And so if he does these sorts of measurements, then he's going to, with high probability, make one of these outcomes the wrong outcome and be detected. That's the idea. So let's calculate some probabilities. Suppose I embed 8 of these atoms inside money, then the probability that the counterfeiter can just guess every measurement correctly, okay? So he guesses whether it was X or Z for each one, and then he does a measurement along that basis. And then if he does that measurement and then makes a bunch of copies of that money based on the results of his measurements, so let's say he gets, you know, X green, X red, Z green, and so on. He now prepares a whole bunch of them all in that way. And now if he happens to have guessed correctly, all of his measurement outcomes will be correlated with the stuff in the bank, and he can then go and use all that money, and it would all be good money. So this is the probability that he can basically make an arbitrary number of copies of money that works. And it's probability half to the power 8, because each one of these atoms, he can only guess correctly Z or X with probability half. So that's already a small number. But if I wanted to make it even more secure, I would just throw more atoms in there. If I threw 100 atoms in there, then its probability of being able to make a large number of copies would be a half to the power 100, which is extremely small. You can also ask, once he's said, tried to make a copy of the money, what's the probability that the original money actually will now pass the test at the bank? A few slides back, I showed how if you do one of these measurements, what's the probability of passing the test afterwards when you pass the particle behind the wall? It was 3/4, because you know, even though you might have guessed wrong, you still have some probability of passing the test. So his probability that the original passes the test is 3/4 to the power 8 in this case, or power however many atoms you have, which is also a small number. So not only can you not counterfeit this money, not only can you not make arbitrary numbers of copies, if you even try, you ruin the original money that you started with. So the moral of the story is, in the future, when we have quantum money, don't measure it, whatever you do, because it'll be no good. Now, I was searching the web, and my credit card company had this new promotion for the MBNA Quantum, and I didn't know what it was, but it said practical, powerful, indispensable, and then, you know, when it was advertising, it said solutions for your everyday and not so everyday needs. And so I was thinking this must be counterfeit-proof quantum money, but it turns out actually it's just a credit card with some terms. We have to wait longer to have the counterfeit-proof money. Okay, so that was the first application. Questions about that? Yeah?
Why can you be assured that you don't measure the whole thing by accident?
I guess that would be an implementation problem. So if people embedded, in my example, they're embedding atoms inside cavities. Measuring it by accident could also be thought of as interacting with the environment. So even if this atom were just to interact with some stray photon or somehow some other degrees of freedom came to be correlated with it, well, then that acts like a measurement. It causes it to fail to test back to bank. So the technological problem here is really to isolate these degrees of freedom from the environment, and so to have them so well sealed off from other interactions that they can actually persist coherently for a long period of time. So if we actually had this as a practical technology, then that would be saying basically that, you know, they don't accidentally get ruined. So effectively, that's what you just asked is sort of the technological problem we have to solve. Of course, you know, what it would mean is that it would be hard for somebody to ruin it. They'd have to, you know, crack this thing open, for instance. You know, you'd have to make it so that it was clear that these things don't just get destroyed accidentally. Yeah.
But when you measure, like, to compare the state to the one that the mint has recorded, wouldn't the measurement change the states and therefore they no longer make it valid?
Well, because the mint has a copy of precisely what is the correct measurement to do, so they know that the first atom was prepared with a Z box, so they measured in a Z box. And that won't change what the outcome of a future Z measurement is, because any sequence of Z measurements always repeats the same outcome. But if the mint had lost track, then not only could they verify that it was good money, they would lose the ability to verify it was good money, and also they would disturb it. So it means that you have to have that information. Other questions? Yeah?
Is it possible that people just measure money all the time to ruin it?
Yeah, it's an interesting concern, yeah. You could, destroy money very easily. But I suppose, the same is true today. If I wanted to, I could burn money. And sometimes I do want to, but it's infrequent that happens. Okay, so let me move on to the next application, which should also be quite obvious now, which is eavesdropper protection. So you have two parties, Alice and Bob, and they want to communicate. The information, you imagine, is private, and so they don't want anybody else to eavesdrop on their channel. Here's an eavesdropper. She comes in, adds a wiretap, and if they're talking over the phone, she can hear everything they're saying. What do you do to protect yourself from eavesdroppers? There's something called the Caesar cipher. So this is a very old cryptographic scheme. So the idea is, suppose the message you want to send is, meet me at the river. Then you imagine that ahead of time, the two parties have agreed on a key, which in this case all seem to be some number between 1 and 26. That's private. They agreed to it in the beginning in private, and they haven't told anyone what that number is. So in this example, the number they chose is 2. And then what you do is, when Alice wants to send a message, like, meet me at the river, she takes every letter, and she shifts it forward in the alphabet by the amount that the key indicates. In this case, she shifts it forward by 2. And we imagine that she eliminates all the spaces. So she gets this message, and she passes it over to Bob. And the idea is that anybody who intercepts it won't be able to read the message because, it looks like garbage. Now, what's the problem with this scheme?
It's really easy to crack.
How do you crack the code? What's that?
A program. So
you just try every letter, you try every shift, and then eventually you get it right. Now somebody else yelled out frequency analysis. Who's that? Tell us about frequency analysis.
You count the number of times letters occur, and E in normal English occurs by far the most times, followed by E-A-O-I-N-S-H-R-E-L-E.
And then? No.
Then you count the number of times each letter in the cipher text appears, and the one that appears the most times is
right.
E-E-O-I-T and so forth.
Right. So even if they're not using the Caesar cipher, cryptographers have clever schemes like frequency analysis to try to figure out what the scheme is. Even if you make your scheme more sophisticated, not this simple, typically cryptographers will be able to get some information about the message you sent. Now, there's a scheme that allows the eavesdroppers to get no information about the message you sent. And here's how it works. It's called the Vernon cipher. What you need is a key that's just as long as the message you want to send. So for every letter in the message you want, you have, you need to have a number between 0 and 26 agreed to ahead of time and private, and randomly selected. So prior to parting, Alice and Bob choose a number of random numbers between 0 and 26. This is sometimes called a one-time pad, right? So you sort of have a pad of paper with all these numbers written down on it. And they each have this pad. And then later on, when Alice wants to send a message, she takes out her pad, and she's like, right, OK, M is going to be shifted forward by 7. And E gets shifted forward by 20, and so on. And she just goes through and she works out what the ciphertext is based on the key. And then Bob receives the ciphertext, and he has a copy of these numbers, and so he undoes all of these things and recovers the message. But from the perspective of an eavesdropper, The possible sets of keys are all the possible sequences of however many numbers there are in the message, wherein each one is drawn from 0 to 26. And because the key was chosen at random, each one of those possible paths is equally likely. Okay? So let's say you run a computer program and you say, all right, well, here are all the paths and they're all equally likely. Let me decipher the ciphertext according to each one of them. Okay? There's 26 to the power 10. So you would never be able to do this, but suppose you did. What you'd find is that this ciphertext deciphers into every possible English sentence of that length. Every valid English sentence of that length would be one possible decipher. And every other set of symbols of that length, which wasn't English, would be another deciphering. And from your perspective, these things are all equally likely. They could have been the message that Alice was trying to send. And so at the end of the day, by having intercepted the ciphertext, you have no more ability to guess what the plain text was than if you just guessed without seeing the ciphertext, right? Originally, when you don't have the ciphertext, you say, well, it's equally likely that this person was trying to communicate any sentence of this length. And afterwards, you're in the same situation. So when that's true, when intercepting the ciphertext gives you no more ability to guess the plain text than if you hadn't intercepted it, that's called information theoretic security. So the Vernon cipher gives you information theoretic security. The problem is now just one of key distribution. Typically, because this is a very expensive system, right? If I want to send you a large amount of data in private, we need to start out with a large amount of key. And we need to have distributed that, right? So maybe in the beginning, you know, we've had our one-time pad, or maybe it's on a computer chip, the key. And you know, we sealed it in a briefcase, and you took it off with you. And then later, when you ran out, what are we going to do? Well, maybe I send an agent to meet you and give you more key, but then that agent might be compromised along the way, and somebody might make a copy, and then everything we send in the future is going to be available to the person who has a copy of our key. So this is the problem now. For private communication, it reduces to key distribution. How do I get key from me to you? Quantum mechanics offers a solution. It's called quantum key distribution, and the idea is let's replace these classical signals sent along a telegraph with quantum systems. So previously I was using silver atoms as my quantum systems. More practical here would be the polarization degree of freedom of photons, which you could send down from optical fiber. And in fact, people today are using these sorts of cryptographic schemes. You can actually buy one of these types of schemes, and it uses photon communication. All right, so by now, you'll probably not be at all surprised at how this works. So here's the deal. What Alice does is she chooses a bunch of bases at random. So she chooses Z versus X at random for each of a large number of systems. And she passes each one of these systems through the channel over to Bob. And Bob also chooses measurements at random. Okay, so he doesn't know how these things have been prepared by Alice. He just goes ahead and chooses some random, you know, Z versus X in each case at random. Now, after they've done this, Alice now communicates to Bob what she chose for the first one, what basis she chose for the first one, and what basis she chose for the second, and so on. And they try to locate which ones they chose in common and which ones were different. Question? So here, in this case, they happen to have chosen correctly in the first case. But in the second case, Bob chose to measure X, and Alice prepared along Z. So they discard that pair. They just don't even worry about it anymore. They get rid of it. And they go through the list. And for instance, these guys, Bob happened to guess correctly in these two. But here, he guessed differently. So they eliminate that. And now, what they do, they have a large number of these guys. And they're going to take a subset of them and take a look at whether their outcomes agree, right? So here they say, you know, Alice says, okay, I got green on this one. What did you get? Bob says, oh, I got green. Great. Same here. But here, Alice says, well, I got green. And Bob says, oh, I got red. And as soon as that happens, what can they infer? Right. either, you know, something funny happened, you know, like an interactive environment, or there's an eavesdropper on the line who's done a measurement. They know that the eavesdropper was there, and the eavesdropper also didn't know what the bases were, and so she had to guess at random. And you know, here she guessed right, and therefore she wasn't detected. Here she guessed wrong, but she got lucky and wasn't detected, right, because some of the time she'll get that right anyhow. Here she guessed wrong, but she got unlucky, and she disturbed the measurement, and she was found out. And so what they do is they don't use up all the bits, the correlated bits they've generated. They just take a subset of them, and they test those guys. And if they find that there's an eavesdropper, they discard all of them. They say, look, there's somebody on our channel, and therefore we can't distribute key. But if they look at this subset, which is still, you know, a large subset, and they find that it's clean, and there's no evidence of an eavesdropper, then they have the rest of the set left over, and they say, okay, well, for the rest of that set, we now have correlated bits of information, and we know that there was no eavesdropper, so there's nobody else who knows the correlation. That's our key. We now use it to encode all our messages. Yes?
How do Alice and Bob know when they're using different boxes?
Well, the first step of the protocol is that they communicate to one another what they measured. So after Alice sends the system over and Bob measures it, they then communicate what it is that they measured, but not the outcome that they got. So they actually, over a classical channel that they allow the eavesdropper to listen in on, they say, I measured Z, what did you get? Now the problem is that the eavesdropper only can do her measurements while the particle is passing between them, which is prior to them having communicated that information. So even though the eavesdropper learns that the first one was prepared along Z, she didn't learn it in time to actually make use of that information.
So, for example, Alice says, I use Z, Bob says, oh, I use Z too, but she, the middle person, used to match, she couldn't do anything.
Right, it's already too late. She's passed that system on to Bob, and she can't change what measurement she did.
And they don't say whether it's green or red.
Right, and they don't announce that. Because if they did, then, I mean, that's the information that eventually they're going to use to encrypt, right? So they're going to say, well, this will be a 0 if it was green, and it's a 1 if it's red. And then they use that bit string to encrypt all their data. Yes?
What if instead of measuring, you made a copy?
Good. Very good question. There's something called the no-cloning theorem in quantum mechanics, which prevents you from making reliable copies of quantum systems. Now, we can already see why there has to be a no-cloning theorem from what I've told you. Maybe I'll just put that out there. Can anyone see a reason why it should be impossible to clone? What would go wrong? What of what I've told you would be contradicted if it were possible to clone? Yes?
Well, to clone it, you kind of need to measure it, and by measuring it, you're changing it.
You could say if the particular scheme you had for cloning involved measuring it and then making a copy, then we know that you know all the measurements I told you about disturb the system. But what if somebody said, well, maybe there's a scheme that doesn't involve measurement at all. It's different. Let's just say I gave you a black box and I said, this thing creates two copies of the system. What would be wrong with that? What would be inconsistent with what I told you before? What's that? You could counterfeit money. Yeah, you're on the right track. Essentially, what would go wrong is that if I took a system and I made, say, a really large number of copies, then there was a question earlier about what would happen if instead of trying to distinguish X green, X red, Z green, and Z red, you're trying to distinguish 1,000 copies of one of those. Well, then it's easy to do because you just take statistics. You do lots of different measurements and you look at the statistics, and then you can infer which of the four preparations was done. So this impossibility to gain information only followed if there was a single copy. If you had a large number of copies, you could then gain information. So that's the problem with cloning. It would mean that you could take a single copy and actually distinguish X green from X red from Z green from Z red by making copies and then taking statistics. In the formalism of quantum mechanics, both the no information gain without disturbance principle and the no cloning principle come from the same features of the formalism. But I'm not going into the details. The phenomena is all you really need to understand. There were two other questions. Yes?
Well, if they're not not going to say what color it was, how would they know if their X's didn't match? Or, like, when one X is green and the other X is red, if they're not saying what color they got, how would they know?
Well, so what they do is so let's say they've done this on 1,000 particles. Then they agree to choose a subset of 100 of them at random. So actually, people have pointed out that this should really be called key expansion rather than key distribution. Because one of the assumptions of the scheme is that they already start out with a bit of secret key, which they then use to select which subset they're going to test. Right? So you assume that the eavesdropper doesn't know this little bit of key they start with. They use that key to say, OK, here are the 100 chosen at random from the 1,000 that we're going to test. So they just test that 100. And because the eavesdropper doesn't know which 100 they're going to test, if they find no eavesdropper on that 100, then it's highly likely that the eavesdropper didn't look at the other 900. So it's, again, probabilities, right? If you're sure that you're tamper-free on a small subset, then you can also be quite sure that you're tamper-free on the rest. And so they use the other 900 as their key.
All right.
Okay. And they've never announced whether it was green or red for the other 900. Yes?
They don't communicate whether the green or red they get, like, how do they detect, like, there's, well, say, like, the X and X here, they don't know. So how do they know there's detection here?
So, When I went through this description, I was assuming that these three, for instance, were part of that subset of 100 that they used to test, and that there's sort of 900 more that they're not testing. So there's some that they don't test, and they're the ones that they're going to use later for communication. But there's some that they do test, and so when I say test, I should be saying they do announce what outcome they got. So if this is part of that randomly selected subset of 100. Then Alice and Bob say, right, I got green, and Bob says, I got red, and then they know. And, they communicate that out into the world, so they know the eavesdropper is going to hear this, but that's okay because they're not going to use these guys later. They're going to throw them away, and they're not going to encode any data with them. Yes?
But do you need, like, you already need an original secret key? Can't you just announce out loud that you're going to test afterwards?
Yeah.
You can announce before the testing happens, but you can announce afterwards after Eve has already committed what she's testing.
The key is that it can't be part of the protocol. It can't be that Alice and Bob always use the first 100. Because then the eavesdropper just says, all right, well, I'm not going to look for the first 100. No, I'm going to do everything I can to figure out what the information is, right? And she knows that they're only going to test the first 100. So they can't have it to be part of the protocol. And therefore, their selection of which it is has to be something that's based on private information.
After it's done, can't Alice just run things through a quantum thing and reach the string number and just be like, I just made some random numbers here, so I'm going to test.
Yeah, I think that would work. I think that's right. That's right. So. There's something called privacy amplification, because real life is never perfect. So even if the eavesdropper is not measuring, you always have some interaction with the environment which tends to cause errors, right? So sometimes you do see these discrepancies. So you have to sort of have a knowledge of how much noise is there on my channel, and so you expect to see some discrepancies, and you look for whether the discrepancy rate is too high. That would signal the presence of an eavesdropper. But another thing you can do is something called hashing, where you take your data and you take basically something like the exclusive OR of large numbers of bits, and you generate secret key, a smaller secret key based on your original noisy key. And for that process to work and to be private, you need to start with a little bit of secret key to begin with. So I think what I said earlier was mistaken. That's the reason you need that's really key expansion if you want to do privacy amplification. And I think you're right, as you say, you can only select your subset at random after you've communicated. Thanks. Other questions? Yes?
Is the possibility that the eavesdropper stays in a permanent thing on your line?
Yeah. One thing about this scheme is that the eavesdropper can certainly prevent you from distributing key. So there's nothing you can do about that. So if the eavesdropper's like, right, I'm just going to measure all the time, and Alice and Bob will always detect me, and then they'll never be able to set up key. So that's true. But typically in cryptography, what you're most worried about is thinking that you have a private channel when in fact you don't. I mean, that's what would really kill you. And so from that perspective, this scheme works, that you'll never be in a situation where you think there's no eavesdropper, but there is one. Okay, well, let me move on. This basically concludes the what do you do with quantum mechanics part of the talk. And there's lots of other things, interesting things you can do with quantum mechanics, but hopefully that gives you a flavor. Quantum mechanics is harder to understand than classical theory, certainly, but it gives you these nice applications. And now I want to move on to sort of more foundational stuff, which is, you know, what is quantum mechanics telling us about the world? So the first thing I want to do is tell you a bit about the idea behind hidden variable models of quantum mechanics. And so for this, I'm sort of going to give you a toy theory. It's not quantum mechanics, but it has a lot of similar features to quantum mechanics, and it involves hidden variables. And so in particular, what I'm going to tell you will reproduce all the phenomena that I've made use of in the first bit of this talk. So this sort of theory will be a hidden variable model for those sorts of phenomena. So here's the idea of the theory. It's a world wherein systems come with four possible internal states. So I'm just going to indicate those four states as four boxes. So, and I can put, you know, a dot in one of the four boxes. So these are the four states the system can be in. And now I imagine that in this world, there's a physical principle that prohibits observers from knowing too much about the physical state of that system. Observers are physical systems too, so you can imagine that there's some sort of dynamical law such that when an observer comes up to a system and tries to find out about its physical state, there's something that prevents him from knowing everything. And I won't go into the details of how the theory works, but effectively the principle is chosen in such a way that the only kinds of states of knowledge you have are uniform probability distributions over two out of the four possibilities. So you can know that with probability at half it's here, with probability at half it's here, and with probability zero it's here or here. And I just represent that as, you know, blue in the boxes where it's possible and white in the boxes where it's not. And I also will sometimes just say that it's one or two. So the state of the system is either one or two. But I could also know that it's either three or four. I can know that it's either one or three, et cetera. And there's only six ways I could know that it's two out of the four possibilities. So those are the six states of knowledge you have, and the six possible states of maximal knowledge. But you could also know nothing, which is a state of non-maximal knowledge. And that's all you can know in this theory about the system. So now let's ask, what would the world have to be like such that this restriction on your knowledge was preserved, no matter what you did? So in particular, you can rule out certain kinds of measurements. So suppose you imagine a reproducible measurement of the following sort. It distinguishes the state one from the other three guys. And I just color the two possible outcomes you could get in that measurement, red and green. If it were reproducible, then after the measurement's over, I would be able to do the measurement again and get exactly the same outcome. That's what reproducible means. So if, for instance, I got the first outcome, the red outcome, then I would have to assign probability zero to the other three states. Because if there weren't probability zero, were I to repeat the measurement, I would have some probability of getting the green outcome, and then it wouldn't be reproducible. So if this measurement were possible, then upon getting the red outcome, afterwards, I would definitely be left in this state of knowledge. And that's knowing too much. That wasn't an allowed state of knowledge. This would be knowing everything about the system. So this isn't allowed. Therefore, this sort of measurements cannot be allowed either. The only sorts of measurements that are allowed are these kinds. You can find out whether it's 1 or 2, or whether it's 3 or 4. 1-3 versus 2-4, 1-4 versus 2-3. And that's it. All right, now let's imagine how this might explain this sort of phenomena I told you about earlier on in the talk. Let's say that this box where you press the button and a system comes out prepares one of these physical systems in such a way that you know nothing about its state. So it's equally likely to be any of the four. And suppose that a Z-box just asks whether it's 1, 2, or whether it's 3, 4. Well, what will you get as an outcome? Well, suppose this guy was state 1, and then I come along and ask, is it in the set 1, 2, or the set 3, 4? What's the answer? It's in the set 1, 2. Right, so if it was in state 1, I would get the green outcome. And if it was in state 2, I'd get the green outcome. If it was in state 3, I get red. If it was state 4, I get red. But there's probability a quarter, 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 quarter of each. So if I sum up these two guys, that's probability a half of getting a green outcome. So the overall probabilities are a half to get green and a half to get red, which is the probabilities we saw in quantum theory. Now, what about this measurement? What would the probabilities be here? 50-50 as well, because it's equally likely to be green and red. So that you can reproduce those aspects of quantum theory. And now I want to show you how you can reproduce the other aspects we needed by talking about what happens to this probability distribution after measurement is over. So suppose you do this measurement, green versus red, and you get the green outcome. Well, you know that you have to be left in this probability distribution because that's the only one that will always reproduce that outcome. If I come along and I ask afterwards, is it green or red, again, a second time, I know I can't get the red outcome, so it has to be one of these two guys. So this is the only probability distribution, final probability distribution, that's sure to make the measurement reproducible. All right. So if I do a sequence of two Z measurements, then if I happen to get the green outcome, after that measurement's over, the particle that gets spit out the other side, I know that it's 1 or 2. And I know that it's not 3 or 4. And so when it gets measured in Z again, I know it's 1 or 2. So I know it's going to definitely give me the green outcome. And so I've reproduced that aspect as well, that consecutive Z measurements always give me the same outcome, and it will leave it in the same state. If I do a different measurement and I get the red outcome, then I prepare it in this sort of probability distribution, and that will always give the red outcome in the second measurement. So that's all fine. Now, what happens if I do Z and then X? So what's the probability of getting Z green? Good. And now, what's going to happen when I do the X measurement? 50-50, so that you could have easily guessed that based on what I told you before. The story of what's going on here is that I'm left, after I get the green measurement, I know it's 1 or 2. And now, if it's 1, I get the green outcome. If it's 2, I get the red outcome. So I can get either one. It would have that. All right, so I'm almost done with the hidden variable model. One other thing we need to know is, what happens if initially I have a state of maximal knowledge and I do some measurement on it? What happens after that? Because the previous day I told you what happened if you had a state of non-maximal knowledge. Well, suppose that the measurement didn't disturb the system at all. If you start out knowing that it's 1 or 2, and then you ask the question, is it in the set 1, 3 or the set 2, 4? And you get the answer, it's in the set 1, 3. What was it before the measurement?
1.
Yeah, it had to have been 1, because you knew it was 1 or 2, and then you found it's 1 or 3. So the only overlap is 1. So you know before the measurement is 1. Suppose you also know that the measurement doesn't change the state it's in. Well, then after the measurement, it's still 1. And so if the measurement didn't do anything to disturb the system, after the measurement was complete, you would know it's definitely in state 1, and it's not in any of the others. But that's knowing too much, according to this theory. We wanted to work out what would the world have to be such that you're always faced with this restriction. You can never come to know exactly what the state is. And so the conclusion here is that it's impossible to do measurements without disturbing the system. The only probability distribution, let's say you do this measurement and you get the red outcome, the only probability distribution that'll make that outcome repeat is this one here. It's the only valid distribution. And so what we conclude is that when you do this measurement here, then what happens is that half the time you don't change the state of the system, and half the time you swap states 1 and 3. So in the example I gave, it was 1 or 2 in the beginning, and then you found that it was 1 or 3. So it was definitely 1 to start with. your measurement, 1.3 versus 2.4, half the time leaves it in state 1, half the time changes it to state 3, and you don't know which. And so at the end of the day, you're left with this state of knowledge. Okay, so now we can look at that final non-trivial case. If I measure z, I'll get some random outcome, let's say it's green, and then I measure x again, and I get a random outcome, let's say it's red. And now I do the final z measurement, and I'm going to get a random outcome again. And the reason is that, half the time I get green, half the time I get red. The reason is that this intervening x measurement disturbs the physical state of the system. So in this particular scheme, to get the green outcome here, it had to be 1 or 2. To get the red outcome here, it had to be 2 or 4. So that means that it was really 2. It was 2 when it came to the x measurement. And so if it didn't get disturbed, then when it gets to the z measurement, it's also 2, and you get the green outcome. But half of the time, the x measurement actually swaps 2 and 4. You get the red outcome, 2 and 4 sometimes get swapped. So after it comes out of the x box, you have the 4, and then that generates the red outcome. So you can explain this particular fact about quantum theory using such a model. Measurements disturb the physical state of the system that you're looking at. Yes?
Wait, can you figure out what exactly our particle was at some time in the past?
Good. Yes, you can. So in quantum mechanics, you can do this also. You can, for instance, prepare it in a position eigenstate, and then measure later its momentum, for instance. So I can set up a preparation of position, a measurement of momentum, and then in between, if somebody puts in, say, a box that measures position, I can figure out what outcome they would have gotten by virtue of the fact that I'm feeding in a position eigenstate. But if they put a box that measures momentum, then they're preparing a momentum eigenstate, and by virtue of my later measurement of momentum, I can figure out what momentum they would have gotten. So in this, it's called pre and post selection. You can tell somebody who in between measures either position or momentum, you can predict what outcome they would get in either case. So if you have these funny scenarios where you're retrodicting into the past, you can actually violate the uncertainty principle in that way. Make simultaneous predictions of these two complementary observables. Other questions? The point of all these pictures is just that despite what you read sometimes in textbooks and in papers, people think, well, they're, you know, hidden variable models of quantum mechanics are not very good at reproducing the phenomena of quantum mechanics. On the contrary, a lot of quantum phenomena, in particular all the phenomena we needed to get quantum cryptography and quantum money, and they're all based on essentially no information gain without disturbance, can be easily understood in terms of one of these very simple models where you say, well, knowing what happens in quantum mechanics is you prepare something, say, Z green, that corresponds to preparing into one of a number of hidden possibilities. So there's a hidden variable, which is whether it's, you know, 1, 2, 3, or 4. And the different preparations I can do in quantum mechanics are just sort of restricting the value of that hidden variable in various different ways. And if attempts to measure one variable essentially randomizes some aspect of that variable, then you can never, for instance, know x and z simultaneously, because a measurement of x randomizes z. So you can think of these four states as being specifications of what would happen in both the z and an x measurement. So the first state says you'll get green if you measure z and green if you measure x. And the second state says you'll get green if you measure z and red if you measure x, and so on. So it's all four possibilities of what you might get are encoded into these four states. So this is like saying, you know, a particle comes with both a position and a momentum. And when you measure position, you randomize momentum. And that's why you can't come to know both simultaneously, because your position measurements randomize momentum. So if you first do position and then you do momentum, all you're getting in that second measurement is a random outcome. So this sort of picture works pretty well. in getting certain kinds of phenomena. But it fails to get other sorts of phenomena. And that's the last part of the talk, which is about Bill's theory, or why any realistic account of quantum mechanics must be non-local. So what Bell's theorem proves is not that there can't be a hidden variable model of quantum mechanics. Rather, it proves that there can't be a hidden variable of quantum mechanics that has certain features that you might have expected it to have, certain very natural features, which people often call locality. It can't be local. But I'm going to tell you what that means. So here's the quantum setup. Now we're going to prepare a pair of systems that are correlated. So instead of talking about silver atoms, I'm going to talk about the polarization of light. So you imagine you take some light, you put it through a nonlinear crystal, it turns out you get sort of two cones of light coming out. And if you take just the photons that are in the intersection points of the two cones, these two photons, if this nonlinear crystal has succeeded in generating this, taking this one photon into a pair of photons of lower frequency, then these are in a particular quantum state called an entangled state, which has interesting properties. I'm not going to tell you about the math, I'm just going to tell you about the phenomena. So imagine this whole thing is put into a box, and out of one port comes the first photon, and the other port comes the second photon. And I'm just going to summarize that with one of these boxes. And I want to imagine now that you take one of these photons off to Alice over here, and the other one off to Bob. And suppose Alice and Bob are far apart. And then they start doing measurements. And so I'll call one measurement they can do S, and so they might both do the S measurement. But they have another measurement called, which I'll call T, and they can also do that. So they can do, for instance, S and T, or T and S, or T and T. These are all possibilities. OK. Now, the key is that quantum mechanics predicts that they're going to get certain kinds of correlations. And it's going to say that there's no way to explain those correlations by thinking of the particle carrying a little local instruction set of what to do if you get measured along S, what to do if you get measured along T. And so to make it clear why, we're going to play a little game. So I'm going to need two volunteer photon simulators. One and two. There'll be another opportunity for audience participation. Okay. Good. So the stakes are high because there's money to be won.
What?
Yeah, money to be won. I know. I was going to tell you ahead of time, but then I thought I want the really courageous people to volunteer. Okay, I need somebody to hold the money. There you go. Yeah. Okay. So. That's a whole two. That's one each. Yeah. And you can buy lots of things with that. All right. So here's the game. Here's the deal. So I want one of you to be over on that side of the room. Good, good. You're simulating the two photons that are going to leave the point of interaction and go off and answer questions. So this is what's going to happen. Each of you, so in the beginning you're going to be allowed to collaborate. Each of you is going to, at the end, going to be given an envelope that has a question, S or T. And your task is to return an answer, green or red. Okay? And then I'm going to get those together and see how your answers correlate. And here's the task. If you happen to have gotten the same question, so either S and S or T and T, then your outcomes should agree. But if you happen to have opened the envelopes and found different questions, S and T or T and S, then the outcomes you report should disagree. They should be different. And now the key is that you're not going to be able to communicate with one another. That's the key. I mean, you're not allowed to tell one another across the room, I just opened the envelope and got S. So we're all going to be watching you to make sure that you don't cheat in that way. Your task is to collaborate and figure out how you're going to answer these questions when they come to you. So I'll give you a moment to talk amongst yourselves about how you want to to solve the puzzle. The rest of you should be thinking about how you would solve it. So is it clear what the rules are? Oh, yes. So you guys are ready?
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, so remember, you don't have to come back. I'm going to take it to you. But your task is to just write an answer to the question. Your answer has to be red or green. And can I borrow your pen? All right. Thank you. Thanks. Okay, what do we got here? So, on your right, there was T asked. I'll write this down. So there's a T question on the right, and the answer was green. And on the other side, there was an S question asked, and the answer was red.
Oh.
So they win, because the rules of the game said if they get asked different questions, and they did, so one got asked S and the other got asked T, then their outcomes should disagree, and their outcomes did disagree. So can we please award the prize? Well done. Thank you. Okay, now that you see how easy it is, I need another pair of volunteers. Who's Ani? Ani, okay. And...
Students, anyone?
I had you holding money, so I'll choose somebody else. This guy? Okay, you trust him? He's your rookie pick? All right. Come on down. All right, so... I'll give you a minute. I need somebody to hold the money again. Has anybody got change for a toonie? Well, here, let's put the hold money. Okay, so wait, you have a new game. You have to, I'm changing the rules. Okay, so here's your game. Let me skip this. That's just a... I'll go over that. The reason that a scheme you could use to win the last game is basically the following. If ahead of time you agree, all right, if we get asked S, then we'll answer green. If we get asked T, then we'll answer red. That scheme works because if they both get asked S, then they both answer green. If they both get asked T, they both answer red. But if they get asked ST or TS, then they're answering differently. And that's what the rules said. If you're asked the same, you should agree. If you're asked differently, you should disagree. So this kind of strategy, I don't know if it's a strategy that was applied.
No, we just picked randomly.
That was a losing strategy in the long run. You got lucky. But this strategy would always work. You would always win the game. I just lost $2 for nothing. But so this was the strategy for that game that would have worked. So you have a leg up. But now here's your game. So it's the same setup. You're each going to get question S or T in an envelope, and you're not allowed to communicate to one another what the question is. And now whenever you happen to get the same measurement, so the same question on both, then your outcomes should disagree. So if you both get S or you both get T, your outcomes should disagree. But if you get different measurements, then your outcomes should agree. Okay? So again, I want the rest of you to think about how you would answer the question. Please move to your respective corners of the room. I'll bring you the envelope. Okay. Here's your book. You got a pen here, and
yeah,
this is yours. And now I need somebody to sing the Jeopardy song. And the rest of you should be, you know, thinking about how you felt wrong. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. What have we got? So, over on the left, we had T was the question, and the answer was red. And on the right, T was the question, and the answer was green. Award the prize. Here, I'll leave you the next task of sometimes dividing that amongst yourselves. I suggest hats off. Magnus. Okay. So my question now is, what's the scheme you use? Yep. Yep. Right, exactly. So if I can just have your attention. Here's the essentially the scheme they use, and which always works. Which is they basically said, they wanted to look, if I get S, I'll answer green. If I get T, I'll answer red. If you get S, answer red. And if you get T, answer green. And that way, if they ask the same question, then it's green, red, and they disagree, similarly here. But if they get asked different questions, then colors agree. Okay, so I have one last opportunity for you to make money, which is the last strategy here. That whenever T is made on both systems, so we're not gonna act this one out. Yeah, it's depressing, I know. If T is made on both, then the outcomes should always disagree. But otherwise, the outcomes should agree. So if the two priorities were to be asked SS or ST or TS, then their outcomes should agree. So let me give you a minute to think about it. And then I want to hear what your ideas are for strategies that could win the game. Okay, any ideas? Any ideas yet, or do you need a bit more time? Okay, I'll give you more time.
Yes.
You got one? I want to know if there's a local strategy that you have to use. Okay, so we have an answer here. Let's hear the candidate answer. Somebody? 75% is the highest probability with which you could win.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, well, these guys told me first, so here's the award, $2. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, split it amongst yourselves in an equitable way. Okay, so can somebody explain why you can't do it with 100% probability? Here.
Okay, so your T's have to disagree. So, like, when you go on, you have to say, like, if they ask you, it's you answer this, but if they ask you, the other one.
Yeah.
But then, the as has to agree, as of one person has to agree with the T of the other person.
Yeah.
And the as of one person has to agree with the S of the other person.
Right.
So then, like, you get a mapping, which shows that the T's have to be the same.
Right, exactly, and you get a contradiction. So here's one way to draw it, which is, if T answers green, then this guy's S has to answer green, and then this guy's S has to answer green. And then T has to also be green to have agreement here, but you're supposed to have disagreement here, which would say that this T should be red. And so you've now found that the T has to be both red and green to win the game, and it can't be both red and green, so there's no way to win the game with 100% probability. How do you win the game with 75% probability? If you pick green, for example, then if you get asked any of these three questions, you win. But if you ask the TT question, then you lose. And so 3/4 of the time you win, 1/4 of the time you lose. So what's the best probability of winning? The answer is 75%. And now here's the remarkable thing, and this is the content of Bell's theorem. As it was suggested down here, if you took two photons in one of these entangled states and did special measurements on them, you can choose certain identities for S and T, then you can actually win this game 85% of the time. Okay, so that means that we can't imagine that these photons have sort of agreed in the beginning of what they're going to do. So, you know, they can't have said, all right, if we get encounter an S question, then I'll answer this way, you answer that way, and so on. Because we just saw that there's no scheme like that that allows you to win probably 70%, more than 75%. The question is, how might the photons be somehow cheating? So let's go back to our original game that we played here. We didn't play it, but have you played it? Can you imagine a cheating strategy that would allow people to win 100% of the time or more than 70%? Communicate with each other. So what would you communicate? But what would be the content of the signals? What's the information that needs to be communicated? Right. Tell the other person whether you're an S or a T. And then your original strategy can be supplemented now by knowledge of what the other person was asked. Right. So, for instance, in this game, where's my game? Right. So this guy over here doesn't know whether to answer red or green because he doesn't know whether this guy was asked T or S. But if the person over here says, look, I was asked T, then he knows, I'd better answer red. But if this guy says, I was asked S, then he knows I'd better answer green. And so if that bit of information could be communicated here, then they can win the game 100% of the time. Now, here's the final problem. What if we set up the experiment in the following way? We take the two parties to be very far apart, and we imagine that there's a short time between when they're informed of what they have to answer, what their question is, S or T, and when they have to actually give an answer. So there's some short time here, and similarly over here. And those times are chosen in such a way that this light propagating from this guy over to this guy doesn't reach this guy in time to be able to inform his answer. Right, so it would be nice to cheat. I find out whether I'm being asked S or T, and I immediately send off a signal to you, but that signal will never get there in time before you have to actually generate your answer. Okay, so now the cheating strategy seems to be impossible. And so the question is suppose you set up the experiment this way. right? So we have, back in the past, we have two photons which go up to here and to here, and they get subjected to these measurements. And they have to, and they, the question is whether they can possibly generate those correlations I told you about, 85%. So who thinks that they can generate those correlations? Can. So can they do better than 75%? And who thinks they can't do better than 75%? So everyone's hedging their bets. Nobody wants to commit. Well, if you believe the theory of relativity, then there's strong evidence to think that they can't do better than 75%. Because what cheating strategies do they have available to them? I mean, how will this guy really know what was asked over here? You know, he can't use a local strategy, can't know what was happening over here because the signal doesn't reach in time. So that would suggest that experiments should find that if you really do separate these things out, you can't win the game with better than 75%. But actually, experiments find that you can. Photons do manage to win the game with probability better than 75%. And so you have this tension between quantum mechanics and the theory of special relativity. So experiment can distinguish what quantum theory predicts and this 75% prediction of any local theory, and you find that quantum theory wins. It's the 85% probability that you do observe. So the mystery, in my opinion, of Bell's theorem is that is the following tension. It's not an outright contradiction, but it's a tension, which is that we know from the theory of relativity that there's no superluminal signaling. So two parties who are space-like separated can't transmit information to one another. So if so in that previous diagram, the soonest I can get information to you is at the speed of light, no sooner, in the sense of a message. Nonetheless, if I want an explanation of how you could possibly win this game with probability better than 75%, I have to imagine that there's some sort of signal that propagates from one end to the other of the experiment that informs the other end whether it's an S or T measurement being made here. And so I have to assume that there's some sort of superluminal causation happening. Why, if that's true, why can't I use that causal mechanism to signal? So the tension is, if there really are these influences that are going faster than the speed of light that explain the correlations in Bell's theorem, then why can't I use those to be signaling? That's the tension. So this, I would say, is one of the biggest mysteries in the foundations of quantum mechanics. I don't think anybody has a really good explanation that satisfies me as to how to resolve this tension between relativity and quantum mechanics. So it's a wide open field for you guys to make progress on. Probably what's going on is that there's something fundamentally wrong about the framework we're using to even think about this problem, that the way we're characterizing it is just not right, and we have to somehow reject some aspect of the framework we're using. But many other people will give you different answers. Some people think that, you know, Bell's theorem is not so crazy. But hopefully I've convinced you that it's somewhat mysterious. And with that, I think I'll end. Thanks so much.
Any informal questions? And hey, I'll talk again. Okay.